Young Man of Providence by Mike Walker, with Q Burden as the narrator and David March as H.P. Lovecraft.
The Case of Howard Phillips Lovecraft.
That is not day which can eternal lie, and with strange eons even death may die.
Chile, Englosna, Kusyu Rilie, Aranahi Sartani.
In his house at Rilie, dead Husu waits ringing.
The region we are about to enter is one of evil repute. There are legends of a thing which is nightmare itself. To see it would be to die. But it makes men dream.
Howard Phillips Lovecraft, the Young Man of Providence, died on the morning of March the 15th, 1937. He was, outside a small circle of friends and the readers of a pulp magazine, completely unknown. The last years of his life had been spent in the shadow of poverty and illness. At the end, even his faith in his own work seemed to be fading.
Every aptitude I wish I had, I lack. Everything I wish I could formulate and express, I have failed to formulate and express. Everything I value, I have either lost or am likely to lose. So far as solitude is concerned, I probably capture all metals. And even amongst my correspondents, there are fewer and fewer who coincide with me. The new generation has grown away from me, and I find myself alone on an island with youth and all the possibilities departed, leaving me stranded with nothing to look forward to.
When he died, he was 47 years old. For years, he'd been referring to himself as an old man. In fact, he said that he seems to have been born old.
My infant attempts at versification led me to the Queen Anne authors. And as the books I used were not modern reprints, but the musty old volumes themselves, I began to use the long S and date everything 2 centuries back. When I was 10, I set to work to delete every modern word from my vocabulary. I had been able to read fluently from the age of 4, and the mellow tomes of the family library became my complete world. They became my servants and my masters.
The titles told him much. They were the forbidden things from the dim, fabulous days before man was. The infamous Culte des Ghouls of the Comte d'Erlet. The Unaussprechlichen Kulten of von Hunst. Old Ludwig Prim's hellish De Vermis Mysteriis, and in the translation of Olius Wormius, Alhazred's blasphemous Al-Azif, known as the Necronomicon.
The wind gibbers with their voices, and the earth mutters with their consciousness. They bend the forest and crush the city.
Man is not the oldest or the last of Earth's masters. Neither does the common bulk of life walk alone.
As a foulness shall ye know them. Their hand is at your throat, yet ye see them not.
The old ones were, and the old ones shall be, not in the spaces we know, but between them.
Who Kothiu is their cousin. Yet he can spy them only dimly. Yog-Sothoth knows the gate. He is the gate. He knows from whence the old ones came. He knows where they shall come again.
I was born on the 20th August, 1890, at number 454 Angel Street in the city of Providence, Rhode Island. When I was three, my father was stricken with a complete paralysis, resulting from a brain overtaxed with study and business cares. He lived for 5 years at a hospital, but was never able again to move or utter a sound. My mother and I lived with my grandfather, Whipple Phillips. I was a nervous child and very restless. I was often ill, missing school on one occasion for 2 years. I had no playmates. Children disliked me, and I disliked them. When I was 6 or 7, I was tormented with a nightmare in which monstrous entities called night gaunts used to snatch me up by the stomach and carry me off to the towers of dead and horrible cities. Or to a great gray space where I could see miles below the needle-like pinnacles of enormous mountains.
Out of what crypt they crawl, I cannot tell. But every night I see the rubbery things, black, horned and slender, with membranous wings and tails that bear the bifid barb of hell. They come in legions on the north wind swell, with a seam clutch that titillates and stings, snatching me off on monstrous voyagings to gray worlds hidden deep in nightmare's well. But if only they would make some sound, or wear a face where faces should be found.
His education was, for long periods, under his own guidance. And though he was undoubtedly intelligent, with a phenomenal memory, his enthusiasm tended to be short-lived. For a while he studied chemistry, then geology and astronomy, then the poetry of the Georgian age, which chimed in well with his admiration of Britain.
As a child, I always had the impression of being English, and my allegiance was commanded by Her Majesty Victoria, Queen of Great Britain and Empress of India.
His mother encouraged his odd delvings. She thought he was destined for great things, but she also thought and said that her son was so hideous that he hid himself away and wouldn't go out for fear of people seeing his terrible face. It was nonsense, of course. But what was a child already given to nervous illness to believe? A child who at the age of 8 had discovered the work of Edgar Allan Poe.
Poe was my god of fiction. I used to love the horrible and grotesque. My world became darkened by the miasmal exhalations of the tomb. As I approached the arch, I began to perceive the presence more clearly. And then, with the first and last sound I ever uttered, a ghastly ululation that revolted me almost as poignantly as its noxious cause, I beheld in full, frightful vividness the inconceivable, indescribable, and unmentionable monstrosity which had by its simple appearance changed a merry company to a herd of delirious fugitives. I will not even hint what it was like, for it was a compound of all that is unclean, uncanny, unwelcome, abnormal, and detestable. It was the ghoulish shade of decay, antiquity, and desolation. The putrid, dripping eidolon of unwholesome revelation, the awful bearing of that which the merciful earth should always hide. God knows it was not of this world, or no longer of this world. Yet to my horror, I saw in its eaten away and bone-revealing outlines a leering, abhorrent travesty of a human shape, and in its moldy, disintegrating apparel, an unspeakable quality that chilled me even more.
Nearly mad, I found myself yet able to throw out a hand to ward off the fetid apparition which pressed so close. When, in one cataclysmic second of cosmic nightmarishness and hellish accident, my fingers touched the rotting, outstretched paw of the monster beneath the golden arch. I did not shriek, but all the fiendish ghouls that ride the night wind shrieked for me, as in that same second there crashed down upon my mind a single and fleeting avalanche of soul-annihilating memory. I knew in that second all that had been. But in the cosmos, there is balm as well as bitterness. And now I ride with the mocking and friendly ghouls on the night wind, and play by day amongst the catacombs of Nefrenkar in the sealed and unknown valley by the Nile. And in my new wildness and freedom, I almost welcome the bitterness of alienage.
I know always that I am an outsider, a stranger in this century and among those who are still men. This I have known ever since I stretched out to touch that abomination, stretched out my fingers, and touched the cold and unyielding surface of a mirror.
He began to create his own worlds, not just as a childish refuge, but as a very real alternative. Under the influence of a growing obsession with the 18th century, he began to see himself as a gentleman amateur, who studied because he wished to, not for qualifications to earn money. His formal education, such as it was, limped on to the end of high school.
I liked high school, but the strain was too keen for my health, and I suffered a nervous collapse after graduating. I was such a nervous wreck that I hated to speak to anyone or even to see or be seen. I shut out the world by pulling down dark shades and using artificial light.
There seems little doubt that Lovecraft was suffering from some sort of organic illness. Some of his symptoms indicate an abnormally high insulin production, exacerbated by his love of sweet things. He was also oversensitive to cold, suffering physical collapse in temperatures below 20, and being comfortable only when it was above 80. As to the relationship between mind and body,
the more we know of psychology, the less distinction we are able to make betwixt the functional disorders known as mental and those known as physical.
His grandfather died a few years before his graduation, and he had moved with his mother to a smaller house. Their income was low after the failure of the family business, but rather than go out into the world at this time, Lovecraft shut himself away, a process that was helped by his mother's increasingly odd behavior. Visitors were not encouraged by her muttering about the weird creatures that rushed out from behind buildings and corners when it got dark. However, Lovecraft wasn't entirely cut off from the world. He had discovered the Amateur Press, an association of little magazines produced by and for amateur writers and journalists.
It is a pastime, but it is more than a common pastime. It is at bottom a spontaneous striving for untrammeled artistic expression on the part of those unable to speak as they choose through the recognized literary channels.
It was the perfect medium for the gentleman amateur. And though most of his early contributions were in bad verse, he also produced a few stories of wonder, which created a certain interest and brought him into contact through letters, some of which were as long as 60,000 words, with fellow spirits across the country. And it was this correspondence which was to become, in time, his greatest pleasure.
As to my letters, my case is peculiar. Indeed, epistolary expression is with me largely replacing conversation, as my condition of nervous prostration becomes more and more acute.
This was written in December 1917. Where Lovecraft was trying, of all things, to get called up in some capacity to help the British war effort. Though in this case, his loyalties were, to say the least, equivocal.
The enemy has the preponderance of superior blood. If the Allied nations were as thoroughly Teutonic as Prussia,
the end would be nearer and happier, and Anglo-Saxons and Germans would not be driven into unnatural alliances with alien races. As for myself, I am naturally a Nordic, a son of the thunderers and the Arctic winds, and brother to the frosts and auroras, a drinker of foemen's blood from new-picked skulls.
But whilst he rhapsodized about Teutonic strength and racial purity, the reality was, as so often, different.
The head physician of the local draft board directed me to class myself as totally and permanently unfit. As he pointed out, my lack of physical endurance would make me a hindrance in any work requiring schedule and discipline. Also, my manifold weaknesses make me unable to endure any condition of living except those of a comfortable home.
It is not reassuring to see the rotting gambrel roofs of the deserted and ruined houses. There is a faint, malign odor about the village street, as if of mass mold and the decay of centuries. The natives are now repellently decadent, with the well-defined mental and physical stigmata of degeneracy and inbreeding. It is always a relief to get clear of the place. Afterwards, one sometimes learns that one has been through Dunwich.
The figures moved uncertainly. They sent a shiver of horror through my frame. Their features were indistinguishable, but their crouching, shambling gait was abominably repellent. I began dreading looking at them as they passed. I saw the close, moonlit space where they would surge by, and had curious thoughts about the irredeemable pollution of that space. They would perhaps be the worst of all Innsmouth types. Something one would not care to remember.
West of Arkham, the hills rise wild, and there are valleys with deep woods that no axe has ever cut. There are dark, narrow glens where the trees slope fantastically. The place is not good for imagination, and does not bring restful dreams at night.
Arkham, Innsmouth, Dunwich. The New England landscape that had been the one unvarying pleasure of Lovecraft's youth. But a landscape that was becoming subtly altered by his own peculiar vision. A vision that had been growing in complexity throughout his 20s, as the world had begun to force itself upon him, despite his reluctance. That he should turn to literature to express himself was no surprise. He'd been doing that in one form or another all his life. And fantasy, too, had been a natural refuge ever since that first discovery of Poe. And it was by Poe and Lord Dunsany and Machen that his earliest stories were influenced. Although that sense of the landscape that was later to be so strong is present almost from the beginning, as are certain hints of the great old ones who were to haunt the later works.
There is no legend so old as to give it name or to recall it was ever alive. But it is told in whispers around campfires and muttered in the tents of the sheiks so that all the tribes shun it. And it was of this place that Abdul Al-Azrad, the mad poet, dreamed.
That is not dead which can eternal lie. And with strange eons, even death may die.
In 1921, his mother died after a long illness.
This bereavement decentralizes existence. My sphere no longer possesses a nucleus. Since there is now no one person especially interested in what I do, or whether I be alive or dead.
His mother, he felt, had got what she wanted, annihilation. But this only brought all the closer his own dilemma,
I have never been able to soothe myself with the delusions of religion. And I have been forced to confess that mankind as a whole has no goal or purpose whatsoever, but is a mere speck in the unfathomable vortices of infinity and eternity.
His aunts, Lillian and Annie, were now living in the house, and they supplied his material needs, whilst he tried to come to gentlemanly terms with infinity and eternity.
I am contemptuous of myself for continuing to live without the least valid excuse for prolonging so dismal a farce. I seldom awake without disgust at the necessity of remaining conscious another 16 or 17 hours before I can find oblivion again.
Three times Randolph Carter dreamed of the marvelous city, and three times he was snatched away while still he paused on the high terrace. And when, for the third time, he awakened with those hushed sunsets still untraversed, he prayed long to the hidden gods of gloom that brood capricious above the clouds on unknown Kada in the cold waste where no man treads.
There was no dream world yet, but there was writing and his love of New England. And as he regained some of his balance, he began to travel around the province, visiting fellow amateurs, including a Mrs. Sonia Green.
She has a mind of singular scope and activity, whose generous cast is by no means feigned, and the volubility incidental to a non-Aryan heritage should not blind the observer to the solid and genuine cultivation which underlies it.
Mrs. Green, who was divorced, began to exert more and more fascination over Lovecraft.
I am coming to be convinced that the erotic instinct relentlessly clutches the average person to a degree which makes its overthrow by higher interests impossible.
Over the 3 years of their acquaintance, Sonia certainly overthrew something in Lovecraft.
The old sleep was over. And unless I wish to face a new and voluntarily eternal sleep, I must secure the settled and bracing environment which can electrify a senile shuffler into a real man. New York, of course. So, stupefying as it sounds, the unbelievable is a reality. I am a householder and partner with that most inspiring, intelligent, and devoted of mortals, Sonia H. Green, in the truly classical institution of holy matrimony.
Edward Darby's mother died when he was 34, and for months he was incapacitated by some odd psychological malady. His father took him to Europe, however, and he managed to pull out of his trouble without visible effects. Afterwards, he seemed to feel a sort of grotesque exhilaration, as if a partial escape from some unseen bondage. He was 38 when he met Asenath Waite. She was dark, smallish, and very good-looking, but something in her expression alienated sensitive people. It was, however, her origin which caused average folk to avoid her. She was one of the Innsmouth Waits. And dark legends have clustered for generations about crumbling, half-deserted Innsmouth and its people. There are tales of horrible bargains about the year 1850 and of a strange element, not quite human, in the ancient families of the run-down fishing port.
In Sonia, Lovecraft found a human being who cared for him and was prepared to treat him as an equal, even defer at times to his ideas of what was proper to a gentleman. Unfortunately, Lovecraft himself just wasn't able to sustain such a relationship. Faced with the task of earning a 9-to-5 living, his approach was hopelessly impractical.
If an unprovoked application for employment seems somewhat unusual in these days of system agencies and advertising, I trust that the circumstances surrounding this one may help to mitigate what would otherwise be obtrusive forwardness. I am 34 years of age and of cultivated ancestry. My education is of a gentleman and embodies all the essentials of liberal culture.
He did find one job, working for a debt collection agency in one of the toughest parts of the city. He lasted 2 days and collected no debts.
A gentleman born and bred has very little chance of success in such lines of canvassing salesmanship, where one must be either magnetic and captivating, or else so boorish and callous that one can transcend every rule of tasteful conduct and push conversation on bored, hostile, and unwilling victims.
He was becoming increasingly depressed, both by New York and by the kind of life he felt himself forced to live there. And as a result of the pressure, all his old xenophobia came to the surface.
The loathsome Asiatic hordes trail their carcasses over streets where white men once moved, and air their odious presence and twisted visages and stunted forms until we shall be driven either to murder them, or emigrate ourselves, or be carried shrieking to the madhouse.
That Lovecraft was himself near a total breakdown at this time is no excuse for this kind of ranting. It was, like most of his opinions about the world, born of a total and blinding ignorance. And when he did come face to face with other races, as in the case of his Jewish wife, his prejudice vanished in the clear light of reality. His fear, his hate, was of the unknown. And in his secluded world, that was almost everything. In fact, the relationship with Sonia was never really strong enough to sustain itself under this kind of pressure. For if there was a love in his life, it wasn't to be found in Sonia. They got on well enough together, enjoyed each other's company, and drifted apart amicably after a couple of years. There was nothing really to hold the marriage together. As far as Lovecraft was concerned, his heart was in New England, not in New York with Sonia.
Providence. I know what it is, and I have never mentally dwelt anywhere else. When I look up from my work, it is Angel Street I see. I have no emotional, as apart from intellectual, conviction, but I am not in Providence at this moment. Indeed, psychologically speaking, I am. And always will be there. My life lies not amongst people, but amongst scenes. My local affections are not personal, but topographical and architectural. And it is New England I must have, in some form or another. Providence is part of me. I am Providence.
And to Providence he returned after 2 years in New York. And it was the return that finally finished off his marriage. A Providence gentleman supported his wife. He was not supported by her, as Lovecraft had been. He'd been earning a little money as ghostwriter and reviser, but not, in his opinion, enough. He and Sonia were divorced without any bitterness in 1959, and he went back to his old way of life, sharing a house with his aunts, attending to his correspondence, and writing. And under the stimulus of his return to New England, his work had begun to blossom. Perhaps not least because he had at last found a market in one of the many pulp magazines which had sprung up in the 20s. It was called Weird Tales. And at first, Lovecraft was diffident about offering his work. It was not quite a gentlemanly thing to do. And even when he was finally persuaded, he was anything but enthusiastic.
I have been lately hounded by nearly a dozen friends into submitting a few of my gothic horrors to your periodical. I have no idea that these things will be found suitable, for the only reader I have in mind is myself. But should any miracle impel you to consider the publication of my tales, I have but one condition to offer. If they cannot be printed as they are written, down to the very last semicolon and comma, they must gracefully accept rejection.
It often seemed as if Lovecraft was his own worst enemy, arranging his life in such a way as to allow his own particular imp of the perverse full rein.
I sent the stories to Weird Tales, and the editor replied that he liked them, but could not consider their acceptance till I sent them in double-spaced typing. I am not certain whether or not I shall bother. I need the money badly enough, but oh, how I hate typing.
He did retype his stories, and soon they began to appear in almost every issue of Weird Tales. His future was looking assured. And yet, instead of producing more original work, he redoubled his ghosting, for which he was paid very little, and his amateur projects, for which he was paid nothing. It was as if he saw success as the failure of all his gentlemanly ideals. And in a sense, he was quite right.
I can never countenance commercialism as an ultimate object, nor feel any lasting or genuine sympathy for its methods. With me, the objects are the creation of something of intrinsic excellence and the supplying of basic needs. If my own survival cannot be ensured as an incidental to the pursuit of these objects, then I feel something is wrong. But just what to do about it, I cannot tell.
But if he couldn't tell, he could write. And that is what he began to do. Just as he was Providence, so the threats and dangers that seemed to loom everywhere in his life took life of their own, rising out and threatening the New England towns and countryside that were the real hero of his work. He began slowly, and with painful precision, to create the great mythic beings that dominate the landscape of his later stories and last years.
I found myself faced by names and terms that I had heard elsewhere in the most hideous of connections. Yagoth, Great Hulthu, Tathagua, Yog-Sotha, Leng, the Lake of Haley, the Magnum Inamanandum, and was drawn back through nameless eons to worlds of elder, outer entity at which the crazed author of the Necronomicon had only guessed in the vaguest way.
There have been eons when other things ruled on the earth. They had great stone cities, and the remains are still to be found. They died vast epochs of time before man came. But there are arts which can revive them when the stars come round again in the cycle of eternity.
All my tales are based on the fundamental premise that common human laws and emotions have no validity or significance in the cosmos at large. One must forget that such things as organic life, good and evil, love and hate, and all such local attributes of a negligible and temporary race called mankind have any existence at all.
The great old ones had shape, but not of matter. They could plunge from world to world through the skies, but when the stars were wrong, they could not live. They lie in their great stone houses in the city of Orlie, preserved by the spell of the mighty Hulthu.
In his house at Orlie, dead Hulthu waits dreaming.
The most merciful thing in the world, I think, is the inability of the human mind to correlate all its contents. We live on a placid isle of ignorance in the midst of black seas of infinity, and it was not meant that we should voyage far. The sciences, each straining in its own direction, have hitherto harmed us very little. But someday, the piecing together of dissociated knowledge will open up such terrifying vistas of reality and of our frightful position therein that we shall either go mad from the revelation or flee from the deadly light into the peace and safety of a new dark age.
The old ones, eh? They had shape, but that shape was not made of matter. They lie awake in the dark and think, whilst uncounted millions of years roll by. Even now, they talk in their tombs and mold the dreams of men.
and men formed their cults around idols brought in dim eras from dark stars. That cult will never die till the stars come right again. And a secret priest will let Great Khufu from his tomb and resume his rule of Earth. And then mankind will become as the great old ones, free and wild beyond good and evil, with laws and morals thrown aside, and all men shouting and killing and reveling in joy. Old ones will teach them new ways to shout and kill and revel and enjoy themselves. And all the earth will flame with a holocaust of ecstasy and freedom.
He created the conditions in which his own work was under threat. And as his reputation grew, he retreated further inwards and created more obstacles. He had a novel, but when a publisher begged for a long work, he denied its existence. He turned down offers from experienced agents in favor of a friend who sold nothing for him. He ghosted a whole book on speech and grammar for a fee of $100 and wrote another on Canada for nothing. Finally, he even began to lose confidence in himself.
It is possible that I have wholly lost the knack of fictional formulation and ought to cease altogether from attempting stories. Nothing recent has really come alive. But at my age, I know I shall never be able to utter what I wish to utter. I have something to say, but can't say it.
He foresaw the total collapse of everything that made his life bearable.
So far, I have kept a goodly number of old family items around me, but when my final financial collapse occurs, there's no telling what will happen. I simply cannot think or calculate in terms of gain. And this will prove my destruction in the end.
And yet, faced as he was with ruin, self-induced or not, he began at last to relax in his relationship with life. He gave up, indeed poured scorn and derision on his earlier racialist attitudes. And he came to see that his own Puritan heritage was often sterile and inward-looking. He even began taking an interest in politics, voting for Roosevelt in the 1936 elections. It was as if only before leaving the world could he find within himself any real affection for it.
Loathsomeness waits and dreams in the deep, and decay spreads over the tottering cities of men. A time will come.
3 times I dreamed of the marvelous city, and 3 times I was snatched away while still I paused on the high terrace above it. All golden and lovely it blazed in the sunset, with silver basin fountains of prismatic spray in broad squares, and wide streets marching between delicate trees. And on the steep northward slopes climbed tiers of red roofs and old peaked gables harboring little lanes of grassy cobbles.
Some have said that Lovecraft is more interesting than his fiction, but he is his fiction, and that is why it has survived. In the landscape of New England and the formless terrors that dwell there, this Puritan without a god has created a chilling autobiography, one of the strangest and most painfully accurate ever fabricated.
When for the 3rd time I awakened, with those hushed sunsets still untraversed, I prayed long and earnestly to the hidden gods of dream that brood capricious above the clouds on unknown Kadath, where no man treads.
In March 1937, Lovecraft entered hospital with suspected cancer. He had been feeling unwell for many months, but by the time he was examined, it was too late for any help. The disease had spread throughout his body. He died on March the 15th. He was worth about $500.
Life is a nightmare, and letters an affectation. For me, the abyss and the spaces between stars where outlaw demons stalk unsmilingly and unpurposefully.
Since the entire plan of creation is pure chaos and wholly devoid of value, we need draw no line betwixt reality and illusion. All are mere effects of perspective.
Your gold and marble city of wonder is no more than the sum of what you have seen and loved in youth. It is the glory of hillside roofs and western windows aflame with the sunset, of the flower-fragrant common and the great dome on the hill.
Providence by Mike Walker. The narrator was Hugh Burton. H.P. Lovecraft, David March. The first reader, Blaine Fairman. And the second reader, Gerard Green. The Young Man of Providence was directed in Bristol by Sean McLaughlin.